You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo. All right, guys. Thanks for joining us for episode 56 of the Reinvest Podcast. I know that's an arbitrary number, but most of our listeners don't know. We've been doing this for a year and a half now.
A year and a half. It's flown by. It's been pretty crazy.
Oh, the places we've been, the guests that we've seen. But just want to say thank you to all of our listeners who have followed us along that time. Your feedback has been invaluable to us. And, you know, we started this as a way to bring some high level concepts from people who are doing things in different strategies, different markets, bringing it to you. So that you can, you know, add that to your tool belt. So we're gonna keep plowing forward, but wanted to say thank you.
Today we have a great guest. His name is Ross MacArthur. Ross, how you doing?
Very good. How are you guys today?
We are doing well.
I was reflecting on your name before the episode, and I was like, you sound like an English billionaire. Like, you're like a monocle and a pipe away from fitting that kind of avatar.
Aren't you disappointed?
What you should have said is, I get that a lot. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I would have been the most interesting guest ever. By the way, if we ever do a follow-up episode in the future, you know that's exactly what I'm coming on with.
Yeah, there you go.
It's going to have to be in an English accent too. So
that's awesome. So Ross, you spent 15 years somewhere in the software sector. So go ahead and tell us about that time, what you were doing, and then maybe a little bit of an intro, how you tripped your way into real estate.
Yeah, it's so first and foremost, you guys are Ohio Midwesterners. I'm a Michigander. I think that's Midwesterner, Michiganders. Those are all real words, I think. but, you know, so we're Midwest guys. So one, we'll get along great, right? But it's so I grew up there, and like most people, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I went to college and got a business degree. And I essentially, when I was done with school, said, I'm going to go anywhere, any place that pays me a decent wage. And so of all things, I ended up in the automotive sector in the very beginning. So I moved to Portland, Oregon. It was like you drew out of a hat where your territory was going to be. And I left Michigan. I've never been, you know, west of the Mississippi, and boom, I moved to Portland, Oregon. So wow. I spent about 3.5 years out there, which was, I mean, it was an incredible experience, to be honest with you. And I also, for any listener out there, I think, you know, outside corporate sales is one of the best jobs you can have, especially as a young person. You learn a ton about just business and how people operate. So that was great. And then I had an opportunity to go to a startup company, which gave me a little bit of that entrepreneurship bug. And I really saw behind the scenes, and that got me into software. Sold that company off, moved to Florida, and I've been in Florida for almost 10 years now. And during that time, you know, I've always had this, I guess, interest in real estate, but no one around me did real estate. Like you guys have had these guests on who are like, oh, my dad or my uncle or my neighbor. None. I had none of that. I had a buddy who, when I was, you know, in high school, my college roommate, that said, man, real estate's awesome. You should look into investing one day when we get older. We should do it together. And that's the only person who's ever talked to me about real estate.
Wow. So even when you were in Portland, it wasn't in front of you. You were in the entrepreneurial scene for business, but never the real estate component.
Never the real estate component. But I always found it interesting, I guess, is the best way to describe it. And so when you're on the road and you're traveling a lot, you know, you're killing time, and podcasts like yourselves and all these audio books, you know, over the years have become so much more readily available. I just started listening to stuff. And like most people do, all the books you can think of, all the podcasts you can think of, and just kind of sat on the sidelines. As that continued to grow, you know, I moved up into executive roles at a software company, that was at for the last 10 years. And in about 3 years ago, it was January 2020, I finally decided, like, it's time. Like, let's do something. And like most people, I was looking for a cash flowing state, did a bunch of research, landed on Indiana, and bought a fourplex. And that kind of got us started. And really, the original goal was solely to lower retirement age. There was nothing else. That was the goal. Four units. I want to buy, you know, maybe 10, 12, 14 the first year. Next year, maybe 25, maybe the following year, get up to 50, things like that. Nothing like we did now. And so that was really the goal. And that the first one went okay, got us a little bit hooked. And, you know, we'll talk about more where we're at now, but that's how we got started. And I'll tell you what, as two guys with families, doing that first thing is like, you got to sell your wife for a significant other heart. So we look back on that now and it's like, wow, you know, that was really scary. And now we're doing things that are, you know, much scarier.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're like, how do we ever convince our wife to do this? You know, especially, you know, for us, some of those initial projects starting small, you're a little more hands-on because you haven't scaled to be able to implement a construction crew or a property management team, you know, and you're very involved. So it's a lot of long, long days, long hours. So you guys started your company Follow the Brand, right?
There's really a couple different companies. The one that you're referencing is called Follow the Deal, which is our group investing company. But when we started with my husband, wife team, it was just for us. So it was just a LLC set up for our business. And that was just going to be our small multifamily buy and hold. And that was it. And eventually, and we can get into that now or later, whatever you guys prefer, but Follow the Deal was eventually born.
So you guys started scaling into the Indianapolis, Indiana, kind of those markets, emerging markets, strong Midwest. And that, you know, it's funny, over the last probably 3 years that we've been kind of heavily applying ourselves into the syndication space, multifamily space, the conversation shifted from East Coast, West Coast, and it started to bleed into the middle of the country. And now the conversation is Midwest, Midwest, Midwest. And it was kind of the unsung hero or that, you know, that ugly stepchild because it didn't produce some of the appreciation and returns that the rest of the country was seeing. Now that we're in a market with 8% interest plus, the Midwest looks super attractive. So it's a really relevant conversation. But one of the things I wanted to talk about today is you, in some of the notes that you shared with us, you know, using that phrase, the velocity of capital, the velocity of money. And how do you cycle capital faster to build that snowball and gain that momentum? Equally, you know, there's maybe on the other side of the coin or the other side of the tracks is managing your debt to equity ratio and keeping track on that. And with just rapidly changing market conditions, you know, is that still a good strategy? So that's kind of the topic I want to jump in today. And I think it's going to give us some opportunity to talk about what you guys are doing currently with some of your other companies. But talk about that velocity of money. If you were sitting with your investors or you know, a buddy kind of over a beer, how would you explain that and kind of break that down for our audience?
Yeah, and I'll probably take a step back and maybe finish up a little bit of kind of where we started and where we're at now, because it doesn't make a lot of sense unless I do. So MacArthur Holdings don't worry about the brand or the name. That was my wife and I's business. And that's where we really learned about velocity of money. And it's a term that I didn't know a lot. Obviously, it's an industry term that you guys are super familiar with and your guests are probably pretty familiar with at this point in time. But when we bought that first fourplex, we just did the traditional 25% down, right? 25% down. We bought it okay. It was fine. We're just hoping to make a little bit of cash flow. Well, as that progressed, what we started to figure out, and we're like, this is going pretty well. Let's try to get more. We were struggling finding on-market deals. So we actually went the off-market route, direct to seller ourselves. And a lot of my background was in software and direct to consumer marketing. So for me, that was a pretty easy concept to grasp.
Yeah, right.
In front of this, find people that would be maybe willing to take an offer. And so we did that and we hacked into like our HELOC line of credit for our house. We tapped into a $50,000 loan from our 401ks because we both had corporate jobs. And so we're like, we're going to go buy these things cash and we're going to find a bank locally that will allow us to refinance that immediately for what it appraised for, not what we bought it for. So that's the key concept. And a lot of like big banks, you know, your commercial lenders don't always do that, but local credit unions, your local mom and pop banks do. And we learned from a lot of people like, hey, just start calling around and asking the question. Well, we found three different ones at the time. And so hey, let's use one to start. And we bought a house for, I think it was $80,000 and it appraised for $100,000. And so we were able to pull out everything but $5,000 from that duplex. So that's when the light bulb went off. Like, holy crap, like I bought something and I only have to have $5,000 into it and cash flow. Like, this is a beautiful thing.
Right.
And so That at that point, that was in June 2020, light bulb goes off and we're like, let's go. Right. And so then the next one, not only did it appraise super well, we got $10,000 back from the bank. So zero money in it plus capital.
We just got paid to flip a house. Yeah.
Yeah. So we tapped into these kind of our equity on our house and our 401ks, and we just started rolling. And so that's how we went from thinking hopefully we'd buy maybe 10 units in the first year to, you know, really in a year and a half to about 120.
Wow. And so at that time, were you able to find banks that would waive the seasoning period?
Yes. And that was the key to our success, right? So people are listening on the phone, like, don't let people tell you that, or on the podcast, don't let people tell you that that doesn't exist. It absolutely exists. Yep. You just have to go find it.
Yep. And we'll vouch for that even locally. Like we work with probably five or six local regional banks. And at one point in time, I think there was one or two that would waive the seasoning period for you to do a cash out refinance based on appraisal, not, you know, the capital you have invested in it. And, and that's a big deal because, you know, 6 to 12 months, think about having projects open that you can't refinance on, especially in the last 18 months where interest rates have gone crazy. You missed your window to be able to lock in that long-term debt. So you found the right lender and you were able to move quickly to be able to get to that refinance.
Yeah, exactly. And then what, you know, eventually you kind of cap out of that one. So we had a backup and another lender. We had really three ultimately locally that were able to allow us to get to that 120 units. And if you think about it, like very tactically, like if you have $100,000 and let's just say average, you know, duplex is you're going to buy for 75 or 80. We were turning our money, that $100,000 every 4 to 6 weeks.
Wow. Just on wow.
Because we would buy, we'd already have the lender lined up. I knew how to, you know, hey, here's some rent comps. Here's what I think I can get it to you. You know, all we would just load their lips and they were used to us, right? So relationship was built and we would have our money back ready for the next purchase. Already, by the way, under a PA, already under a purchase agreement, I'd get my money back and then I'd close on that one. Dude. And rinse and repeat.
And this is what I want to pull the curtain back because it's easy to look at that and say, I'm going to go do that right now. Well, it's a little bit of a different market. It doesn't mean that you can't do it. So I want to talk about kind of the current market cycle and all the confusion that there is with that. But you had the right pieces in place and you were able to move quickly. So, I mean, that really is a perfect case study of the velocity of capital. Can you throw some rough numbers on that? Like, okay, we had a $50,000, you know, loan on our 401k. We had a HELOC. We started with this nest egg. And then we scaled it to X.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a little bit blended capital as far as like what was in our bank versus what we took from a HELOC and a 401k. But let's just round up and let's just say we had access to about $250,000. Well, we took that $250,000 in the course of a year and a half and had $7 million of assets by the end of that year and a half.
That is so wild, dude.
That's crazy. Now, granted, we didn't buy them for that's what they appraised for. So we bought them for, right? But it is. And, you know, one of the questions, I'm going to hit it now and we can talk about it more later. And then maybe I'll jump back into where the story ends up. But you asked about like the current, you know, atmosphere, right? Could you be over leveraged and things like, absolutely. Anybody can be over leveraged, right? But as long as you're buying something right, with a decent debt on it and plenty of reserves in the bank with fail safes, like why wouldn't you want to max leverage?
Yep.
Where people get in trouble is where they're not conservative enough on the property and the underwriting and what it needs and capital expenses, right? They don't have enough reserves. And then of course, you know, it doesn't perform well and they have no fallback, right? So, you know, it's as long as you're doing all those first initial steps, like why wouldn't you max leverage? And then if you're in a really good position with 8% interest rates, when they go back down to 5.5 or 6 or whatever, you refinance, you're in an even better position.
And most of the properties you'd be going after anyway, they're cash flowing assets. So it's not like you're buying on the basis of appreciation. You're not buying just hoping that the area improves. You're buying with cash flow, knowing that even if you leverage 75% LTV, you're fine either way.
100%.
But I want to play devil's advocate here, okay? Just a little bit, because to be fair, a lot of us, you know, even if you've been investing for 10 years, technically you haven't really seen a full market cycle yet. And so we're kind of building a strategy off of something that it's not that it's untested because people have been doing cash out refinance forever, right? But when you stress test a deal, you think you're stress testing it to what you think is going to be bad or the correction that you think is going to happen in the market. And what if it's worse than that, right? So so just playing devil's advocate a little bit, do you, like, what would you say to somebody who's like, hey, I try to stay at like that 50% equity to debt ratio in my portfolio? Do you think there's wisdom in that? Do you think that that's a now thing? Do you think that never really has its place as long as the deal pencils and you can take it to the limit on leverage?
I mean, on small multifamily, single family homes, it, you know, the big apartments is totally different. That we'll get into what we do now. But, you know, I think you can't argue with somebody to be super conservative with 50% debt ratios or some zero, right? Some people, I know a bunch of people who have, you know, single families and small multifamily where they just buy one a year, they try to pay cash for, and they put zero debt on it. Like, you can't argue with that. Our strategy is to maximize velocity, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just a different strategy. And I think, you know, the one of the topics, you know, we'll probably get into at some point is like this MB and how, you know, there's so many ways to do it. And people look at one way as the only way. There's not. I mean, whether you max leverage, whether you, as long as you're safe, whether you have zero leverage or whether you have 50%, it's really a personal strategy. And every one of those has pros and cons. And yeah. So I think to your point, like, you know, that's great. I would say, man, that's a great strategy for them if that's what they believe on and that's what's successful. For us, we want to create that velocity, work super hard on it early and often, and then hopefully be able to taper back in a couple of years and just let it ride out.
And I think, you know, we've mentioned this on our show before, but I feel like if John Wooden was a real estate investor, he's all about fundamentals, right? So there's the three immutable laws: long-term fixed rate debt, plenty of cash reserves, and cash flowing assets. And it's like that has to continue to be the bedrock on which you invest from. And although that strategies fluctuate, right? Because right now, finding a deal that you can refinance on and pull all of your capital out is tough. But maybe with market conditions, you're going to pull 75% of your capital out and you're going to leave 25% in. So maybe you're not going to cycle it as fast, but the principles are still there working for you in this current time in the market. So I think it always has its place. You just have to know, like, it's easy to come in and think, oh, I know the principles, and then you can get burnt really bad because you're just making these generalizations about the market, about real estate, about a certain deal, and you don't really understand how they all work together. And you guys have been doing it long enough to know, okay, here's how much capital we're going to put into this. Here's how much we're going to borrow from the bank. Here's the leverage ratio we're going to go for. Here's what we think if there was a correction, you know, we anticipate rents would dip 10%, but not 20%. You've been doing that long enough. So
real quick before
Seth, go right ahead.
No, go ahead. You finish your thought and then I'll jump in.
So I think one of the things that I think why we all do real estate, or at least people want to start doing real estate, because is there's multiple exit strategies. And I think as long as you're not pigeonholing yourself into one, I think that's another area that people get in trouble. Mm-hmm. Like, I have to refi. If I don't refi, I'm screwed.
That's true. Like,
bad strategy, right? You only have one exit, you know, but if you could sell it, if you could refinance it, you know, if you could, you know, whatever it might be. I guess there's really only a couple different strategies, but you know, you guys get the point. As long as you're not pigeoned into one, I think that's where people get in trouble.
Was it Ray Dalio that said, I invest in something that pays me daily, weekly, and monthly? You know, those types of businesses, and that multifamily is that, right? I mean, that's that type of asset.
So as we're talking about velocity of capital and your strategy specifically, I think a lot of people would say, okay, I could wrap my head around doing that a couple times a year, but really at some point, people are going to be limited to their debt to income ratio and how fast the bank's going to even look at their rental income. Because a lot of banks around here, it's like, hey, we want to see your rental income on your tax returns before we'll actually count that towards your DTI.
Right.
And sometimes they'll work with you on commercial loans, but how was that for your experience, especially scaling to 120 units in a year and a half? I mean, did that ever come up with the banks? Were they pretty flexible with you since you had the personal relationship with them?
A little bit of both. So I think one of the things is my wife and I were both, you know, W-2, high performing W-2 employees. And so there's so much propaganda in 2023 that's out there about real estate, get quick, get rich quick schemes, essentially, like you can make a dollar, be a millionaire overnight. That's all bullshit. Sorry, but it is. It's a lot of work and it takes time. Yeah. And so, we were able to kind of support our portfolio from a debt standpoint with our income and our savings. And so we didn't rush into this. You know, I joked with you guys beforehand, I'm going to be 39 here coming up next month. You know, I started doing this 3 years ago. So, I had 15 years of essentially a double W-2 dual income family. So I was very different than a 19-year-old going to buy his first house. So that kind of, hopefully that answers your question, Seth, but that's kind of one, I think, to kind of lead into, oh, go ahead.
Well, I mean, that does help. And I mean, for anybody listening, sometimes we see people that are scaling super fast.
How are they doing that?
How are they doing that? What are they doing? How can I do that? And then people get frustrated when they keep running into these barriers.
Yep.
But what people don't look at is the 10 to 15 years you spent in another industry, but you were still building wealth. You were still saving money. You had a 401k
to borrow against. Yeah.
You were still, advancing in your careers. So, and that's the building, the backbone of what your business started on. And it's hard for someone who's new, who's 20, 21, 22, just starting out, making no money,
right,
and trying to scale really fast.
Well, hey, Ross started 3 years. I started 3 years ago. Why am I not where he's at today? Well, Ross, had some context that you don't that way. So that's important context, I think, when you're playing your strategy. It's consistency and it's long-term commitment to that, to those fundamentals. But go ahead, Ross. I didn't want to cut you off there.
Actually, you guys offline were talking about how we kind of became accidental flippers. That's why I call ourselves my husband-wife team. They're accidental flippers. And everyone wants to flip a house, but it goes to your velocity and money. So everyone always says we only have a finite amount of capital, and that's true. And so we were buying stuff, we were getting our money back, but how do you go faster? And so we were getting a lot of off-market single-family houses, and I had an opportunity to buy a 16-pack of houses. And my wife and I were just talking about this yesterday, because that was about 2 years ago. And I said, I'm going to buy these 16 houses. She's like, we don't invest in single families. I was like, yeah, but the terms are good. Like, it's a decent deal. They're kind of slumlordy, but I think we can make some money on these. Well, so we bought them, but we weren't flippers at the time. We'd never flipped a house, and we kept getting these single family houses. I kept either wholesaling them, or I'd tell my buddies about them and they would buy them, or whatever it might be. And so we finally decided, like, let's go, let's try one.
Wow.
And also lessons learned later, and maybe a follow-up segment too, of all the things that we figured out along the way. But we did one, and it was kind of painful, mostly because of the contractor, but we did one, we made money. And then we did another one. And then next thing you know, that first year we did 15. And now, this year we're on pace for 30.
That's wild.
It is. I have to honestly, I'm thankful for the people around me that help me, because that's not me, right? I'm the money guy, but there's people executing. So that 16 pack of houses has netted us like $425,000 net profit.
Wow.
So we were laughing yesterday. I said, remember how scary that was to do that? And like, that group of houses so far, because they're not all done yet, because they have renters in them. And when the renters move out, then we flip them. But velocity and money, that starting the flip business, and I don't suggest it for everybody, because it is a lot of work and there's a lot of ways to fail. But with people, process, and technology, we were able to scale that and then create another avenue for velocity and money, right? Because I'm injecting quick cash. I'm relatively getting quick cash within 90 or 120 days back after we sell it. And then I'm taking that and I'm putting it into now larger apartment buildings, just another avenue of velocity and money.
That is fascinating. And so going back to, the exit strategy or just the pivots and stuff, when you bought that 16-house package, did it cash flow as a rental portfolio?
It did. I mean, we bought them for just under 30 grand a house.
Wow.
So it was like, thousand in tertiary small town market, 16,000 people market. But and they were, I mean, a couple of them were, I would say at the time, you maybe let's call them four, maybe five would be considered like, that's a good flip house. Like that you could see like, oh, it's a decent area, like that's a good flip house. The rest were like, eh.
It could go either way.
But what's happened with the market is affordable housing is we're just in it, right? So if we live in that $100,000 to $140,000 house range.
Yeah.
Like after renovated, you know, for flip price. And so most of those, if not all of those, live in that category. So a little bit of luck, right? You know, that what's going on in the market, a little bit of a chance and being in the right spot for the opportunity. But yeah, I mean, it's they all cash flowed at the time. So we made money off the rental side. And then obviously we made money off the flip side.
That's like the best of both worlds.
That's awesome.
Cause you, again, you didn't have to flip them, right? I mean, that was kind of like the vision, but hey, if the market turns and there's an oversupply or, you know, lending just comes to a halt, we can pull back and the rental market's strong enough that we could hold this and not lose it. But yeah, that is very fascinating. So that was another income stream. I think the question everybody has when they hear somebody has a flipping business at that scale is how do you find a crew or crews to do that and not pull your hair out? Because you're in Florida right now. Like,
I've never been in most of these houses ever. So corporate America has kind of imprinted many, many things on me. And one is kind of the term people, process, and technology. So you guys have a lot of different revenue streams and businesses and brands and things like that. If you kind of boil it down, any part of what you do, I do, or you know, Amazon does, it's people, process, and technology. And so, you know, people is, I think, the toughest thing in any business. And so, you know, one of the things is that, I mean, I kind of joked when I mentioned that first house. I mean, we had two contractors on the flip side, both stole money from us because we are out of state and we had checks and balances, but if I'm being, you know, hindsight 2020, there should have been more. We put a lot of work into finding the right person. And fortunately we were able to, who had a 12 person crew and we started extremely slow with them. Like, here's one, we're going to check it like twice a week before we give you any more money. I'm going to check it again, you know, and we built up enough rapport to now it's just a really well-oiled machine. And then we have, you know, in your guys' world, we have a great realtor who's not only on the hunt for off market, but on market items. And they work directly with my construction team. So she's by the houses two or three times a week. I get pictures from the construction crew almost daily. Wow. And so didn't start there, right? So, you know, by no means it was a well-oiled machine back then. And there's a lot of bumps now, even today, there's a lot of bumps, but you know, we're right now tracking to do 30 by this year. And I'm hoping that we can stay between 25 and 30 next year. But it's the construction crew is the number one, I think, thing in real estate across the board. Yeah. It is so hard to find good people for a fair price.
I will say this. We have seen an uptick of contractors and subcontractors reaching out to us for work. And so I think what's happening is they're kind of burning through a lot of the work they had lined up because money, I mean, you had residential people pulling the trigger on stuff that they'd wanted to do for 10 or 15 years because they had stimulus money and just money in the market was,
debt was cheap.
Yeah. Like here, leverage up on your HELOC, you know, like go to 85%. So, but that's starting to slow down. And now those guys are saying, hey, do you have some work? Do you have projects that need done? I hope that's going to help. For people who have projects that need to get done in the real estate investing side of things, I don't, you know, fully know, but yeah, it's fascinating. Take us in, man.
Oh, to our smaller pockets.
Are you ready for our smaller pockets?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go.
All right. So the smaller pockets is the part of the show where you tell us a deal that went wrong. So what went wrong in the deal? It could have been for one of your multis or it could have been, you know, some of your flips or something. What went wrong? What did you learn from it? And so that way our audience can avoid the same mistake.
So I think I just kind of hit it and I didn't want to steal the thunder of it. So I'm going to repeat it, but rephrase it. So one of the things is being in the Midwest, let's be honest, we're pretty trusting people. That's just kind of the way we're brought up. And so I just assume in general that other people are trustworthy. I've learned over the years and become more jaded, you know, but general, you know. And so when we first did that flip and we've now been stolen from four different times, two on the flip side, two on the apartment side or slash rental side, is that there has to be a level of trust but verify. Mm. And so, you know, we've probably lost to the tune of $60,000, maybe closer to 70 at this point in time over the years from, you know, shoddy work or just pure like stolen from, like they charged us $35,000. We got about $10,000 worth of work. And, you know, we've been, you know, I'd like to think pretty uber successful in real estate as a whole, but we make a lot of mistakes like everybody else. And that's one of them. And so we have a lot more processes built out on that. But the kind of positive side of that is we've never lost money. Mm-hmm. And now that's coming. So to all your listeners, like, that's going to happen one day and we're going to, we're gonna lose money. And that's just the world we live in. Welcome to it. And, but we haven't yet. And what's really nice is those flips and those rentals, we've actually exited most of those properties at this point in time. And we've had six, you know, I would say severe or extreme success on each one of them. So we've made up that difference, but actual transaction with that contractor, we lost money and it is incredibly painful and pretty almost heartbreaking when that happens because you just don't expect it to. So
because you wouldn't treat somebody that way. I think that's why it feels unthinkable as you're like, there's so many times where Seth and I will look at something play out and we're like, why? But why? Like, because one
I would
deal,
never do that.
Yeah, right. Like, and even
it's short-sighted.
It's so
that contractor could have fed himself for a really long time on your business if he was just had integrity.
Yep.
But it's that short-sighted mentality that we all fall into from time to time.
That's true.
But especially, I feel like in real estate, it happens all the time with people getting greedy and seeing, you know, and it's probably that way in every industry. But we see it a lot in real estate because we're doing it all the time.
So $60,000 is enough to qualify you to graduate from the School of Hard Knocks. All right, you've got your master's level in that. Because I think that's a very relatable dynamic that investors find themselves in. You rely on other people. Even if you're overseeing a project, if you have a subcontractor on that project, that's still the same dynamic. What were the processes that pain kind of created that you guys implemented in your business moving forward in that contractor investor relationship?
Yeah. So there's kind of different ones. On the flip side, I mentioned it, right? So there's video check-ins, there's picture check-ins. Anytime there's a draw, I understand what's that next phase that we're going to be doing for that money. And then my realtor is also then checking physically, double checking what they're sending us, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a check and balance there. I also go check on a lot of the projects, usually once a month myself, just to, you know, surprise verification. And then when you talk, we didn't get much into it today, but we've graduated to a company called Follow the Deal that me and my partner Stan started, which is about 20 to 120 unit apartment complexes, which is very different from the flip and small multifamily. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate enough to help buy into a vertically integrated property management company that's dedicated just to us. And so taking that same process that we have on the small flips and things like that, we've now created that verification process on the large stuff. And so we have weekly updates, we have status reports, we have videos, we have pictures. We have directly from the contractor and from our property managers on site. So all those same things we've now just implemented at our 100 unit apartment complexes. It goes back to that trust and verify. Even though that we do that, there will be a time when we're still stolen from. It just is. Right. It's the business. And that's sad.
Do you explain kind of the, like, let's say there's a new contractor that you're looking to work with and their team. Do you explain ahead of time, hey, here's what our processes are and going in length? Because I feel like that in of itself would vet somebody of like, if I didn't want that level of accountability, I'm not going to return your phone call. Cause you're telecasting and projecting to me that you're not a guy I'm going to be able to like screw over very easy.
Yeah. One of my favorite sayings, and I use it constantly, is, you know, set expectations and then inspect what you expect. Right. So if they agree, you know, Gary, if you say, yeah, I'm in, like, I want this job. I verified your work. I feel comfortable with who you are and your background. I give you the opportunity. Here's my expectations. And we've fired three people in the last 6 months because immediately they started to go awry. And I'm like, nope, you're gone. And so, but I felt fine about it. That didn't hurt my feelings at all. I told you what we expected. You agreed to those expectations. And I think so many people don't set that up front.
That's true. In
aspect of your life, you know?
That's a great leadership principle. So kind of on the tune of that, we've got two show segments. One was our smaller pockets. Great example there. The second is what we call our little nugget. So this is the practical takeaway, the piece of advice, the hack that our listeners could implement to their real estate investing businesses from you? Could be tried and true, could be very practical.
So I had to think back to this, and it's kind of a tough question to answer because there could be a million. When you're doing it this long, you're like, well, let me write a book about this. And people do, right? They write books.
Right.
And you have podcasts like you guys. But you know, one of the things that I think is a core foundation for anybody in life is if you're going to be successful at something, you got to treat it like a business. And not a hobby, you know, because the second you start creating something, if you don't do it with the right foundation, we all know it's going to crumble. Right. So treat it like a business day one. And we did that, fortunately. And I think that has to, you know, a lot of our success stem from it. But then there's the next level that starts to happen where you overcomplicate it. And so that they go together. And so a good example is I have a buddy who's had, you know, multiple different real estate businesses. And every time he kicks a new segment off, he goes 0 to 60 in it. It's branding and it's Facebook and LinkedIn profiles. It's all this other stuff. He has a concept. Like, he doesn't even have anything yet. And he started everything else in it. Guess what? Most of those businesses have not, I hate to say it, survived.
Right.
You know? And so keep things simple. This business is hard. Don't let anybody tell you it's not. But you don't need to overcomplicate it to get started and get rolling, but you do need to treat it as a business. So I think that's really important. And I think the last little nugget, because I go through this personally, is that envy. You know, yeah, we own 700 units, you know, to date, right? That's a lot. But there's somebody out there who owns 20,000,
yeah,
you know?
Right, yeah.
There's somebody who does 50 flips or 100 flips a year. Like, I don't like to beat our chest by any means. We've been relatively successful, small fish in a big pond. But you start looking around with LinkedIn and these podcasts, like some of your guests, I'm like, oh my God, man, this guy's incredible. Like, I'm like, he's awesome. I listen to you guys. I'm like, I wish I could speak this well on a podcast. Like, you know, there's envy all around us. And I think the most successful people kind of put blinders on they just figure out what's best for them and then they do it.
Yeah, that's good, dude. That is really good. Because the age of social media, everything is flaunted in front of you. And here's the thing that we realize. You talk to enough investors. When someone says, hey, I have 2,000 units, they could be a capital raiser or a limited partner in that 2,000 units and have a minority interest in that.
2%.
You know, so like the numbers are really irrelevant. But there's this perception that you can get caught up into. And I think what I'd like to add to that is the blinders. To have that mentality, it takes discipline. It doesn't come natural because you're assaulted with that all the time. It takes discipline to do that. So how have you guys stayed disciplined to, and I kind of like stay humble, stay hungry. How have you guys stayed humble, stay hungry when you see bigger fish around you doing bigger and better things?
I mean, we fall into it, if I'm being honest with you. There'll be a day or whatever where I'm like, oh man, I got to do what that guy's doing. He's doing something right. And then, you know, you got to kind of shake it off. I think it's just, there's no secret sauce. It's a mentality, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, you either get sucked into it or you're not. I mean, it's just, it's a mental or mindset thing. So I don't have any secret words of wisdom besides like make up who you are going to be. Listen to people. Like there's no, if you guys were like, hey Ross, like have you ever thought about doing this? I would be all ears.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense. I would implement it, but not if it goes against our core beliefs and our foundation. Right. You know? So I think it's just a mixture of having the right mindset because you have to be humble. And I think a lot of people out there beating their chest, that's not really what's going on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We've seen that for sure.
We have a lot of business. You know, we rub shoulders with investors, but also business owners. And it's wild because I've seen enough now to know that what drives a lot of business decisions for some business people is ego. Like it's not because it makes good financial sense. It's not because it's going to help you, you know, create more jobs or be a better employer or expand. It's literally for one purpose. And the purpose is to show everybody else who you are and what you can do for whatever inner need you think that satisfies. And that sets you up for disaster. Maybe not now, but eventually that kind of decision making is going to have, you know, a recompense involved. So it does take discipline. Take us full circle here, okay? Where are you guys at now? I know you mentioned the 700 units. Give us kind of the vision for your company, where you want to go, and then how can people follow your success?
Yeah. So again, we got started in January 2020. So we haven't been doing this for 20 years or and things like that. So in the grand scheme of my life, where we haven't been doing this a significant long time, but what's crazy is the amount that's happened in 3.5 years. You know, we started with small multifamily, created a flipping company. You know, we started Follow the Deal Investments, and we've done about 600 units under that umbrella now. We're doing about one property a month. We're very, very focused on the Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, kind of Midwest market. We had the opportunity to, like I said, buy into a property management company that's going to be dedicated to us. That just happened. So that's new. Wow. And really, it's about continued scale. So I think, you know, this year we're going to do a lot of rinse and repeating what we've been doing because it's been successful and we're real early in it. But I think the next thing is, you know, we're going to use this time to create operational excellence. I mean, that is, we're going to dig deep on things like our underwriting and our templates that we use. Like, how can we become a little more efficient in that? Because right now, like, I created it, like, it's good for me. But like, how do I create a version that goes to the bank automatically? Mm-hmm. Like, it creates a separate version, one that goes to investors, things like that. You know, how do we create better processes around asset management? So I think, you know, to date, we've been, you know, relatively successful and we want to repeat that success. But I think it's now is about how do we become excellent in the categories that we are, which is real estate. You know, yeah. I'd love to tell you like, oh, man, next time we talk, I'm going to be doing X, Y, and Z. If I'm being honest, I didn't think I'd be doing what I'm doing now.
Right, right.
Half ago. So, you know, you got to kind of be flexible. And I love this. You guys love it. Clearly you have a podcast dedicated to this. And so I hope that I can continue just to grow and continue to show, you know, our family and our friends that there's other ways to make wealth besides just going to school and working for somebody.
What's your 2024 goal for your business?
Oh man. If I say
that's like a, I know that's like a tough question. It's going to put you in the hot seat, but
So flipping business to stay the same, which I know that sounds kind of crazy, but when you're doing 30 flips, like that's a lot. So I'd like to keep that cat in that part of the business the same. I'd like to sell off some of my small multifamily and roll it into our large projects. And I'd like to get to about 1500 units. So I want to double where we're at today. We do have one property in Southern Michigan. I'd like to continue to scale in that Indiana market, but then add a couple other geolocations where the property management team can access and manage as well. So that seems like a really crazy number for us personally when I say it out loud. But yeah. Again, I never thought we'd be at $40 million of real estate. So you got to throw big, crazy stuff against the wall and then put your head down and don't talk about it again until it's done.
Yeah. Dude, let's go. Roll your sleeves up and get awesome. To work. How can people follow your guys' success?
So I'm awful at this. Remember, we kind of said, stay humble. I'm like the worst at anything social media related. So, and I'm almost 40, which kind of makes me feel old. I really, LinkedIn's probably the best if I'm being truthful. Yeah. You know, that's the easiest way. I do try to be semi-active on that. I follow you guys, of course, and what you're doing and try to comment there, but that's always the best way. You know, I would like to say this, we are true operators. Like I was joking with you guys, I just bought a truckload of flooring, like 32,000 square feet yesterday. Like we are in this business. And so if you ever have questions for an actual true operator doing this every day, I'm always happy to answer them though. I mean, somebody along the way helped me. I'm always willing to help somebody else.
And that's what I think we're excited too, is you guys, it's not a course that you're, and I have nothing wrong or against those people that are selling educational courses, because I think there is a place for those. I don't think they're all created equal, but some of the people that I'm most encouraged by are the ones that are like, hey, we're doing this. And if we can help some other people along the way, even in an informal manner, we'd like to do that. You know, that kind of mentality is something that we find is actually pretty prevalent in the investment community, which kind of shocks me a little bit. But Ross, thank you so much for taking time today to kind of peel the curtain back, talk about your story as a case study of how you guys have velocitized capital. And you guys have some big goals, so you're going to need to continue that momentum, but I'm sure you guys will do it.
And for our listeners out there, your takeaway from today is go figure out how to be creative and velocitize your capital in your investment business.
Yeah.
And, right. you know, call us if you want help. So
shameless plug. All right, man. Hey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.